Welcome to Oncology Today, Investigator Perspectives on the Treatment of Endometrial Cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Flor Backus from the James Cancer Hospital and Solove Research Institute in Columbus, Ohio, to discuss current management of endometrial cancer. To begin, I asked Dr. Backus to provide an overview of the treatment landscape of endometrial cancer.
So I think there's a lot going on in endometrial cancer, in all of gynecologic cancer, but specifically in endometrial cancer. We really just talked about low-grade, high-grade about 10 years ago, and that's where it stopped. Then we started having those molecular subsets that the TCGA, the Cancer Genome Atlas, helped us discover. And then we figured out that those groups also have different responses to their to the different treatments. And with that, we have more and more different mutations that we have discovered in it. And as we go further, those mutations, we're now seeing that there's therapeutic options for those mutations. So the landscape is just getting so much more complicated. Some of it is an explanation also for why do some treatments not work in particular subsets of patients, and also why do some drugs work so much better in other subsets. So, but it is more and more complicated, and with the addition of the targets, as you see in this here also, like the number of different mutations and the differences in those mutations, the beta-catenin, the PIK3CA mutations, mismatch repair deficiency, superoficiency, the RAS pathway, and then on the other, the high-grade side, more to P53, HER2, cyclin E, and now all the surface antigens that we can look at with immunohistochemistry for the novel antibody-drug conjugates. Like, I don't know how anybody can keep track of all the things that are happening within gynecologic oncology, let alone, and specifically also in this different subset. So it's getting more and more complicated, and we're not just carboplatin paclitaxel anymore. And I think it's getting more complicated for any medical oncologist that doesn't treat this all the time to keep track of this. I have no idea. I have deepest respect for anybody who still practices the full scope of oncology, but it's getting, I have to imagine, even for us, a gynecologic oncologist, it's getting harder and harder, and I do this every day.
So, you know, again, we could spend hours, as you really, you just alluded to, talking about all the things that are going on, and we are going to emphasize one of the most important, I think, developments in the last few years in endometrial cancer, which is the integration of checkpoint inhibitors, immunotherapy, into the disease. And you know, one huge glaring thing that stands out, and you talk about medical oncology because we have a lot to compare to, is that it's a pretty high fraction of MSI-high disease in endometrial cancer, 25 or 35%. That seems a lot higher than colorectal cancer, where we talk about this all the time and it's studied all the time. But, and we'll get into some of the trials that have come out, but just to note, there's a lot of MSI-high endometrial cancer.
Absolutely. And it's one of the most important things that we have to check right from the time of diagnosis. Yes, as part of our therapeutic options, of course, and whether checkpoint inhibitors are a good option for patients. But also, we can't forget about Lynch syndrome and making sure that we find those right patients that we may find with endometrial cancer, that then we can prevent the colon cancer in the future.
Yeah, I'm going to kind of drill down, too, on not only what's going on today, but what the ongoing trials are looking at, what we might be seeing in the next couple of years. And again, you know, kind of focusing down on immunotherapy, and particularly the immunotherapy in the advanced disease, recurrent, metastatic setting. Of course, you know, we've had the two big phase three trials looking at dostarlimab as well as pembrolizumab. Up front, combined with chemotherapy. Previously, I think a lot of people were getting it IO second line with lenvatinib pembro, but dramatically we had the NRG study and the RUBY study, and so IOs came in right away. But, you know, when the data was presented, it was kind of presented together with the MSI high together and the MS stable, and I'm not sure that even now that the data has been out there for a while, people really have a firm grasp of, let's say, how you think through your algorithm in making decisions in the first-line metastatic setting. Again, both MSI-high and MSS-stable, very different situations. So can you kind of summarize from your take, you know, what the key points were? And we saw some updates also at SGO and at ASCO and longer-term follow-up from these two critical studies. But sort of where you've landed and where you see your colleagues in, you know, clinical investigator oncology, gynecologic oncology landing in terms of how you, for practically purposes, outside a trial, think through first-line therapy of metastatic disease in the MSS-stable and the MSI patient.
Yeah. I think it's going to be interesting because we were all very surprised, of course, when that data came out now over 3 years ago. We were, at that point, we knew how well the checkpoint inhibitors worked in mismatch repair deficient endometrial cancer and how poorly it worked in the proficient population. So then when that data came out, when we combined it with chemotherapy and then continued with the immunotherapy maintenance in both those trials, that there was a benefit, not just in the mismatch repair deficient population, but also in the mismatch repair proficient population. It wasn't as strong. It wasn't a hazard ratio of 0.3, but it was somewhere between 0.5 and 0.7, which is still very respectable, a 30 to 50% reduction in the risk of recurrence or death. Obviously, any patient would want to take that. So that kind of swung that pendulum, I think, for most providers in treating endometrial cancer, that we started adding in that first line metastatic space or first line recurrence to chemotherapy with immunotherapy followed by maintenance therapy. So that's kind of where it went. And as you pointed out, like we were treating many patients with lenvatinib pembrolizumab at the time of their first recurrence, after they've had already chemotherapy chemotherapy typically. And I think that has gotten less because we're using more upfront endometrial cancer. But if we're thinking about what we're seeing now, I have a feeling, and this is my personal feeling, that the pendulum may swing again. Mismatch repair deficient, the benefit is so strong, and I think we're starting to think about now that we see these long-term follow-up data that we may be curing patients here. But for in the mismatch repair proficient population, where that hazard ratio is good and we see good improvements, but there may be other agents out there, and if we're not curing patients necessarily in that population, we may start using other agent like an XPO inhibitor, XPO1 inhibitor, and we'll have to see what the export trial is going to show. But I get a sense that I predict maybe that pendulum is going to switch and there does not IO for everybody anymore where we're kind of right now.
Yeah, I want to kind of follow up with some specific questions, but just to make a comment, though, on your selinexor thought, I don't know if you know when the phase 3 trial, I guess that's in P53 wild type, is going to report, but I don't know if you know. I didn't realize until we actually got to ASCO, there was a big selinexor myelofibrosis phase 3 study. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, it's going to maybe be first-line therapy in some patients. So it was out there in myeloma before. But getting back to immunotherapy, so let's start out with MSI-high because, again, you get into colon cancer, it's like two different diseases. You know, they're different trials, et cetera, but you guys kind of like talk about them together. But anyhow, let's talk about MSI. So first question is, how do you feel about the chemo plus IO in MSI-high? You have an 85, 90-year-old patient or somebody with a lot of comorbidities. Will you offer single-agent immunotherapy? Any thoughts about that?
Yeah. I think it's a consideration. Depends a little bit on their disease burden. Personally, I think most, even those older patients, and they have a bigger disease burden, they're going to feel so much better when we do a good job getting that treated adequately and pretty fast. So combining it with chemotherapy, and most of these patients tolerate the chemotherapy. You may have to make a little bit of a dose adjustment, and you may not go with your carboplatin AUC of 6, but may start with a 4 or 5. But they tolerate it fairly well and in combination as well. So at this point, for me personally, most patients I'll still give chemotherapy with immunotherapy, even if they're mismatch repair deficient. But that said, we'll see in the next, probably in the next year or so, when those trials come out that are comparing immunotherapy to carboplatin paclitaxel by itself. That doesn't include the current standard control arm with the chemo IO, of course, but still, I think it's going to be very informative data. And the other part, yes, I think it's not unreasonable to drop the chemotherapy. We see in the at least the LEAP-001 from that data in the mismatch repair deficient population that when you compare that to the chemotherapy alone, that and they haven't had prior chemotherapy yet, that that's still a very active therapy, and we may not need the chemotherapy necessarily. So it's reasonable.
So, another issue here in general with IOs, and I'm curious your thoughts about this. This comes up in every disease where IOs are used, is to what extent, if any, is there a tail on the curve? Not just MSI high, but also MS stable. The example I give in terms of that is an extensive stage small cell. They added IO to chemotherapy, and they got like a modest, not even as good a hazard rate as you see with MS stable and endometrial. But after a while, they started reporting a 12 or 15% 5-year survival, which they had never seen before. And even though it wasn't like 50%, it was there for the first time. And that really got my eyes tuned up, so to speak, for looking for that. So right now, I'm sure your patients ask you all the time, what's the chance I'm going to be around in 5 years and, maybe not even possibly cured? What do you say to a patient globally? I know that individually it's different, but globally, if they're MSI high versus MS stable.
Yeah, I think here the data that Matt Powell presented from the RUBY data, and they did some kind of analysis and called it the conditional overall survival. And this was pretty fascinating. It was a bit of a complicated analysis, but what they saw in talking about the mismatch repair deficient population, that if you made it to the 1 year mark from starting treatments, that you had about a 84% chance of potentially being cured, have a 3 year survival of being cured. But if you made it to the 3 year landmark, so that was the end of their dostarlimab maintenance, then you were had a almost 95% chance of being cured. So, or have a long-term survival. So those are really, really pretty awesome numbers. Let me for a second, though, here, pause for a second, because I need to make sure that I'm saying that correctly.
Yeah, because
Yeah, it's
also
just.
I'm not. What I'm really curious. I understand that, that's great, that data you just mentioned. But also, again, when you start out with a patient at the very beginning, and they're MS stable and they're MSI high, and they won't say, okay, at this point, what kind of you might have a physician as a patient. I'm sure you have plenty of physician patients who might ask a question like that. What is the chance that I'd be cured or, doing well at 5 years? What would you say, roughly ballpark?
If you're MSI high, we're now starting to think about in the 80% realm, if you make it to that 1 year, especially if you make it to the 2 and 3 year marks. But if you make it to the 3 year mark, that may be even in the 90% chance. So these numbers are going up. And that's for the mismatch repair deficient population. We don't really have those similar numbers for the mismatch repair proficient population.
Do we know the numbers for the MS stable?
For the stable, those weren't presented. But if we look at the survival curves there, now, for the overall population, what they had in their survival curves, we're looking at somewhere around 40-ish percent at 3 years, probably in the mismatch repair proficient population.
At 3 years.
At 3 years, it was 48. Yeah, 48% at 3 years.
Yeah, that sounds kind of encouraging. Another question is, this again comes up all the time with immunotherapy, is choice of IO. Would you like to kind of compare available data and how that plays out in your practice and other people's practices?
Yeah, I think that is something that you're comfortable with. I don't think there's truly a big difference between, for example, the pembrolizumab or the dostarlimab. Both are PD-1 inhibitors. PD-L1, there may be some differences there. But the hard part is that in the other trials, we didn't see as consistent of an effect in the mismatch repair proficient population, at least. But we also included different populations in those. There was more Asian population in those studies that used PD-L1 inhibitors. So is it the PD-L1? Is it the population? Because we just didn't see as good of a response in the Asian population. So we haven't really figured that out yet.
So what about for practical purposes right now? From your point of view, your fellow comes up to you and says, which IO are we going to use? What do you consider reasonable options to in terms of choice?
For me, I kind of stick with the pembrolizumab and dostarlimab. Those we have the most data for. We have the approvals for. Durvalumab is certainly an option too. Just don't use that as often. Maybe if we ever think about like adding a PARP inhibitor to it, would consider that. But I think those are our two main ones, just to PD-1 inhibitors.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about PARP also, but first I want to ask you about also anti-CTLA-4 plus IO. Again, in colorectal cancer, ipi-nivo is very commonly chosen first-line therapy. I mean, you know, people who can handle it, they have very good data there. What do we know about that combination or similar combinations? I see also there's a bispecific that somehow's PD-1, and I don't know how far that's gotten, but what about that strategy in endometrial cancer?
Yeah, I think that's still under investigation. We have, of course, some of the combination data is suggestive that it will be a good response. Do people need it is probably the bigger question. NRG GY025 is currently studying that, and that enrolls the mismatch repair deficient population. And so patients are randomized, and they can have that with prior chemo or without prior chemo also. So I think we're going to get the answers there. I'm not convinced that we need to use that in a mismatch repair deficient population at this time, but I certainly could be wrong about that. We see such good responses with just a single agent, and we certainly see more toxicity when we start combining it, that it wouldn't be frontline. But would I consider it for a patient that maybe has a recurrence, say they had a good response to chemo IO in the frontline, and a few years later they have another recurrence? Certainly that would be something that I would consider using it in a combination in that time.
So another sort of common theme that comes up with immunotherapy are relative and absolute contraindications to using immunotherapy. And two kind of factors that people cite a lot are prior autoimmune disease, as well as prior transplant, solid or otherwise. In this situation with metastatic disease, again, maybe you're more conservative in the MS-stable patient than MSI patient, but how do you think through some of these relative or absolute contraindications? Will you, for example, not use an IO first line, but use it second line? Like, how do you approach it?
Yeah, I think those are two different categories. I certainly, they make me pause for a second and touch base with their transplant physician or their rheumatologist, certainly before they start. It very much depends on how bad their disease is, how many other immunosuppressive drugs they need. If they're just on 10 of prednisone, for example, I think those are patients that are well maintained. But if they need multiple disease modifying agents and the immunosuppressive agents, then that becomes a different story. For transplant, I personally still get a bit nervous. That's a big deal if something goes wrong in a transplant room. For rheumatologic disease, the threshold is probably a little bit lower, especially in the event of metastatic disease, because we know that if you stop your IO and you use steroids to suppress them again, you can get disease control. But Transplant makes me nervous, where I can really do some serious damage that I can't reverse easily. So not without a really good reason if I really don't have any other options. And it is being studied. So hopefully we'll find out more too, but yeah.
So you mentioned PARP inhibitors, and I have to confess, in spite of hearing a lot of things presented and discussed the last few years about that, I'm still a little bit confused about what it actually means for now and for the future. So maybe you can just sort of summarize from your point of view what some of the key data points have been or trials looking at this issue and where we are today. Are there situations right now where outside of a trial, you or any of your colleagues are integrating PARP inhibitors? I do see that occasionally in clinical practice. And I guess the big question I hear from docs is, what about biomarkers? You have BRCA patients in there. Do you have HRP patients, et cetera? So where do we stand on PARP in endometrial cancer?
Yeah, I think we haven't figured it out completely yet. For one, it's not FDA approved, the combination with chemo IO and PARP. At least not in the U.S. Yes, in Europe, that's a different story. But here in the U.S., we don't. Certainly, we are not using it in a mismatch repair deficient population. Those really don't need it. The studies, the DUO-E study has shown that pretty clearly that there's not much additive benefit if you add a PARP on top of immunotherapy already in a mismatch repair proficient population now. Yes, there does seem to be some benefit if you look at the curves. It wasn't powered for that, so have to be careful with that. But the curves do separate there. So there's a role for it, but probably really pretty selective. It does add some toxicity. It obviously adds a lot of cost. It's another thing that patients have to take. So in a select, so kind of what you said, occasionally if a patient has a BRCA somatic or germline mutation, that's probably where we consider it. But in terms of biomarkers, we haven't figured out what does that mean, homologous recombination deficient or issues with the homologous recombination repair system. We don't have a good biomarker. We saw a benefit across both the groups in the DUO-E study. And then I think on top of all of that, when we looked at the DUO-E and then we saw some of the Ruby part two data come up that was presented at ESGO earlier this year, those curves the survival didn't look the same. And kind of we saw the curves trending in the wrong direction, kind of what we saw in the adjuvant setting, where Pembro didn't seem to help in a mismatch repair proficient population. So not all PARP inhibitors may be the same, but it's not really quite yet ready probably for prime time use in all patients.
So are there any like phase two data on single agent PARP inhibitors in patients with BRCA, somatic or germline endometrial cancer?
Phase two data as a single agent? No, we have some maintenance data that was presented last year and recently published using a PARP inhibitor single agent in the maintenance setting. Now in that study, that was a pretty mixed group of adjuvant, metastatic, different populations included, but nothing that's been figured out. What is the true biomarker and when should we really be using this? And as a single agent, yes, in this phase two, whether it was single agent or combined with immunotherapy or with antiangiogenic agents from the GY0112 study, we just didn't see much activity there at all. So it's kind of puzzling still.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the ongoing trials, particularly those that are looking or including immunotherapy. And you mentioned the NRG GYO35 study, which honestly, it looks a little retro to me. It's, got Bev in there and, IO, but and three arms, you know. So can you, let's start out with that. Can you talk about what's going to be looked at there and why you're excited or not excited about it?
Yeah, it's probably, it is a little retro, and, you know, it's something that we're going to be able to do maybe with all biosimilars and maybe the most affordable study if that goes forward. But it's interesting study,
good.
Though.
I like retro.
Yeah, I mean, it's
retro's
like, this is like the new purpose for old drugs, right? Or all going to be older drugs. But no, but it's interesting study. It's chemotherapy with IO, for those who don't know, chemotherapy with pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy with bevacizumab versus chemotherapy with pembro and bev in the mismatch repair proficient P53 mutated. So it's a very selective cohort, kind of going on some of the data that we saw in a subset analysis from the RUBY trial, where patients in the mismatch repair proficient P53 mutated population had a significant benefit also from the addition of dostarlimab. So it's interesting to see that combination. You mentioned the bispecific that's coming out. Also, that combines an IO agent with an anti-angiogenic agent, but then obviously as a bispecific. So there's activity there, and there's some biologic rationale to combine those. And I think time will tell if that's how the pendulum is going to switch again in this population.
So you hear a lot about P53 across oncology, and I think we're getting back to your biomarker scheme. P53 is pretty common in high-grade serous endometrial. I think it's like 70% or so. So it's most patients. What's the rationale? Is there there's some thought that maybe Bev or you were talking about, I think it was ivosidenib, which is a big thing in lung. Bev or VEGF agents, that looks better in P53 mutant.
It does. I really noticed from a subset analysis, again, of the GG86P study, that showed that if you had a P53 mutation, that you would benefit from bevacizumab. So we do have to confirm this in a larger study that is kind of pre-planned here. But we have those patients that have in this metastatic, these behave like ovarian cancer, can have a lot of ascites. We know that Bev can help with also controlling the ascites. So it makes sense to combine these agents and overall well tolerated. And we know, of course, from lenvatinib and pembrolizumab already as well.
Yeah, no, that's a great point about lenvatinib and pembrolizumab. But, you know, it's easy to forget. Lenvatinib has a lot of VEGF activity and a lot of anti-tumor activity. So, yeah, that makes sense. I guess maybe someday we're going to have an algorithm P53 positive. We're going to go one way, P53 wild type. We're going to go to a selinexor.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good chance that we're going to land there. Hopefully we'll learn what the outcomes of that trial are. And if they were as good as in the SIENDO data and the phase 2 data later this year.
So any other phase 3 trials that are looking at immunotherapy, not just in the metastatic setting, but also adjuvant, locally advanced setting that you want to comment on?
Yes, I think probably one of the other important ones where we're set in the beginning, like in the first line metastatic, it's at the moment still it went to IO for all. In the adjuvant setting, didn't pan out that way. So when the Keynote B21 study, when they looked at it, that study was chemotherapy with or without pembrolizumab. Patients were enrolled right after surgery with no measurable disease. So truly just a pure adjuvant study. That's where we were surprised that was a negative study. And we actually saw that, yes, in the mismatch repair deficient, huge, same hazard ratio of 0.3 or even lower in some of the newer data. But in the PMMR population, the hazard ratio was actually reversed, 1.2. So we're not helping, and we may even be hurting by adding immunotherapy in the PMMR population in the adjuvant. So that's, I think, hard to forget that the metastatic setting is a little bit different than the adjuvant setting, whether that's because there's disease present or not present, and that may play a role. But we can't just say, oh, yeah, IO for all at this moment.
Yeah, but that study, which a lot of people, including me, did not know about, and I was thinking, and I remember discovering it about a year ago. At the time, if you remember, there was a plenary presentation at ASCO on MSI-high adjuvant therapy in colon cancer that was positive, atezo chemo, and everybody was saying, oh, that's the first adjuvant IO trial that's positive like that, in the MSI-high. And then we looked and we saw what you said, which is actually, it had been demonstrated. The other flip side of what you just said is you did demonstrate the same thing that they saw in colon as you and the adjuvant setting, which is a big advantage, and people ended up quietly using it. But in any event, now it's with colon and everybody's trying to figure that out. There's another study that I saw, Trials in Progress. I love those Trials in Progress posters. This is at SGO. And again, reminds me of things going on in lung and other parts of oncology, colon. Adjuvant dostarlimab with pelvic radiation and locally advanced mismatch repair deficient endometrial cancer. Any comments? Again, kind of reminds me, you have that in non-small cell lung cancer, but there they just given it sort of, without any particular reason. Here you have MSI-high disease, which is fascinating. So any thoughts about that study and locally advanced endometrial cancer and IOs?
Yeah, I thought that I agreed. That was a very interesting study and well done. It was a smaller study, but they showed that if you gave radiation and added immunotherapy to that in that mismatch repair deficient population, that you can get responses that are probably close to or similar to the chemotherapy with IO. So we may not need chemotherapy. We could potentially just do radiation with IO as an alternative also. So that's in the adjuvant setting. Certainly in the metastatic setting, we'll probably still need the chemotherapy along with it. But yeah, in the adjuvant setting, I think that is definitely a way that we could be going if that's something that people are interested in avoiding chemotherapy. And that kind of was a gist of their study also that they said, like, okay, well, maybe this is going to be our chemo free. The question is, like, which one is the toxicity? Which one do you prefer of the toxicities? But yeah, that study is being done. A similar study is being done in on a little bit larger scale in Europe as part of the Rainbow project there too. So it'll be great that we have one here in the US and then also the one from Europe coming out hopefully soon as well.
So, like as you mentioned, this was just a one-arm study, 31 patients with recurrent, with the encouraging data. So, are there phase three initiatives looking at again locally advanced, incorporating IOs with radiation or chemo radiation?
For look in Europe, yes, for that's ongoing. In the US, there hasn't been as much uptake. We just don't use radiation as our primary therapy, as much. We're much more heavy on the chemotherapy and have been. So I think it would take a lot to do that. We tried to look at some of those trials and was just not enough, or to develop some of those trials and wasn't quite enough interest, probably at the national level to do that as a larger trial here. But in the
So
recurrent setting, I
again,
think it's still another setting where we use it. If we think about like the patients that are on immunotherapy, just switching a little bit here, but those that are on immunotherapy and have a good response, then to use targeted radiation in those instances, in clinical practice, I think we do that, probably see that across all disease types within oncology, but can be a very effective strategy.
so just to clarify, though, again, my naivete as a medical oncologist, this dostarlimab trial, the patients were eligible stage 3 and 4A. And again, they got radiation therapy plus dostarlimab. How do you normally, outside a trial setting, manage those patients, and if they're MSI high?
Right now, in that adjuvant setting, for those locally advanced, those patients would be getting chemotherapy with immunotherapy based on the KEYNOTE B21 data. Big phase 3 trial. Yes, it wasn't powered to look just in the DMMR or the PMMR population, but the effect was so strong and so consistent with what we saw in the metastatic setting too, that that is the new standard of care.
So another issue, and I remember we brought this up at the SGO endometrial cancer meeting, CME meeting, was the issue of in MSI-high localized endometrial cancer, the question of immunotherapy, MSI-high disease. You know, obviously in rectal cancer, there's a tremendous amount of excitement. People are getting IOs, MSI-high rectal cancer, avoiding surgery. They're looking at it for colon cancer, although there, obviously, the surgery is not as morbid. And I know, I think we talked about the fact there was at least one study that was being done, I think, in the UK now, looking at neoadjuvant MSI-high localized. Any thoughts about that strategy moving forward?
Yeah. In a neoadjuvant setting, I think it's an interesting study. What makes me pause a little bit is that the study that came out of the Netherlands from a couple years ago, they only gave one or two cycles of immunotherapy and then did their surgery. But the majority of those patients still had disease remaining in their uterus. So while, yeah, we see really good extrauterine responses, I'm not convinced, and we looked at our experience here too, that we can really omit the hysterectomy. There's something different about the uterus as a more protective environment, that we may even see a complete response in the omentum and the rest of the peritoneal cavity and lung and liver and whatever else they had disease in. But in the uterus, there's oftentimes still disease present. So I don't think we can say yet that this is the same, we're going to see the same responses as they did in colon cancer. So I'm still a big proponent of a hysterectomy, even in those situations, hard to forego those. Time will tell. But I don't think we're going to see that same magnitude of response yet.
So again, sort of medical oncology, or oncologist type question. I don't know if I represent an average oncologist or not, but I also am not exactly clear. I mean, I've always been fascinated by the use of surgery and surgical debulking in ovarian cancer. I remember when I was in medical school hearing about that, I was like, wow, that's different. But I'm not so clear about exactly what the role of debulking surgery or even surgery in with patients with metastatic disease in endometrial cancer.
Yeah, we don't have those same studies that we see in ovarian cancer. It's also a little bit different because a lot of patients may present with abdominal disease, but endometrial cancer for some reason has more of a tendency also to go to lung or liver. So that kind of excludes them from that primary debulking. And now I would have to say kind of the current trend for endometrial cancer with the chemo and IO option, both for the DMMR and the PMMR population, is probably that we're giving more neoadjuvant and debulking them later. It's not the same, and we're starting to do more. I see this in our practice here. Instead of going to surgery after 3 cycles, if we wait till after 6 cycles, they have a complete response. And now we may be able to do, or oftentimes are able to do, a minimally invasive hysterectomy. And we take the omentum out, and that's all they need. And the rest of the disease is gone, and then they can go on maintenance. So that paradigm is definitely shifting a bit. It tells us a lot about biology, of course, of disease too, both for how they present, but also how they respond to their treatments and if they become surgical candidates that way.
Another much discussed issue in oncology in general, but particularly people with checkpoint inhibitors, is oligometastatic disease or oligometastatic progression. How often do you see that in endometrial cancer? What kind of sites do you see? What kind of local therapies are used, from surgery, radiation, cryo, et cetera? And if a patient, let's say, is doing really well on IO and they pop up with an oligomet, would you keep IO or systemic therapy going? Any thoughts about oligometastatic endometrial cancer?
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating topic. Absolutely. I think this is kind of where I mentioned earlier also about like you, this is where we use radiation oftentimes. If there is specifically, if there's a lymph node, and sometimes these are isolated lymph node areas, if it's resectable, the preference would be, and it popped up while they're on, say, single agent or maintenance IO. If it's resectable, I think that is a definitely something that we would consider. If it's not, then treating that, and they have a good control everywhere else in their disease, of their disease sites, then treating that specific spot with radiation can be very effective. And whether that's in the lung, even in the liver, we certainly have treated, I've certainly have treated some patients that had a great response everywhere, but had had a response in the liver, but had some residual there after they completed their chemotherapy. And we treated those with just focused radiation, and they continue to do well. So very important to talk to your talk to the radiation oncology colleagues what they can do, and they can do so much more than even just a few years ago.
How often do you see localized disease or localized recurrence as a palliative issue in when people have, you know, advanced disease, metastatic disease? Is it usually the metastatic disease that's causing the issue, or how often do you see localized problems to get out of control?
We see it in, I would say, just kind of two different groups. We see that disease sometimes exploding in like a dedifferentiated endometrial cancer. They come sometimes up with, they have nothing, and then all of a sudden they have a big pelvic out of control mass, may have disease somewhere else too, but that's kind of one presentation. The other presentation is more your low-grade endometrial cancer, or could be a serous, but the low-grade endometrial cancer that has then a vaginal recurrence that's typically fairly small still and can be salvaged and treated with curative intent with oftentimes with external beam radiation and brachytherapy. Those dedifferentiated, and especially when those happen on chemotherapy, and that's usually what we see, are very, very challenging.
So another thing I was going to ask you about, and I sort of alluded to this in the beginning, is kind of like, what's your take on, or what's your observation on, in terms of who treats patients with metastatic endometrial cancer in a tertiary center like yours and in the community setting, a general medical oncology community setting?
I think it's a combination, and it probably gets treated more than we really realize still in the community, because patients want to stay closer to home and don't always want to travel, especially not if they have to travel for an hour or two. So a lot, sometimes that is in collaboration. The challenging part is why when I think like those patients do end up oftentimes with at a tertiary center, it's just after chemo IO. And if they are not HER2 positive and there's no trastuzumab deruxtecan and they're higher grades, there's just nothing else out there. So we're very much reliant for those patients. And there's lots of good clinical trials available. But those are oftentimes not at the community sites because there's not enough patients to enroll and in that category. So I think those patients, I hope, I should say, that those end up making their way over to a place where they can take a look at clinical trial options. There's just, I would much rather see that than the single agent doxorubicin or gemcitabine or things like that being used, because it just, I mean, 10-15% response rates is not very exciting.
I mean, particularly with all the exciting agents, the bispecifics, you know, new targets, et cetera. Incidentally, you see FR alpha with endometrial cancer?
Yeah, there's some studies now.
Does it respond to ADCs?
It does. Just as,
really?
Like, yeah, I mean, the response rate for HER2-3 plus from the Destiny Pan Tumor study was, depending on what you look at, the FDA approvals or the actual study came out, so somewhere between 50% and 80% in the HER2-3 plus population, and it drops off a little bit. But we now have, there's another agent in development targeting HER2. Trastuzumab pamirtecan, and then we have the data on with folate receptor alpha from the Rina-S study. B7H4 is a very promising target in endometrial cancer also that we now, we saw one at ASCO, one at SGO presented. So a lot of exciting agents there in the ADC, and they all have topo one payload, but yes, they are definitely those are good options for patients, and we see now response rates somewhere between 30 and even as high as 67%. So it's exciting times, even for also for endometrial cancer.
Well, also TROP2 ADCs. I know I saw
SAC-TMT.
And well, we already have sacituzumab. I don't know whether Dato-DXd, but is looked at. But yeah, so that would be another drug. But again, just if you had a patient who kind of ran out of options, metastatic endometrial cancer was FR strongly alpha positive, would you give mirvetuximab?
For MIRV, we don't have a lot of data in endometrial cancer yet. I would probably, at this time, with the exciting data with the topo one payloads, I'd probably favor that over MIRV. But other payloads are certainly welcome. And if they're highly folate receptor positive, certainly could consider. We did a study with that. And the response rates weren't bad, somewhere in the 30 to 50% range in smaller studies. So could be consideration, maybe challenging to get an approval for that too. Not quite on the listing yet.
I mean, do you see people with high levels, like 75% with endometrial cancer?
Mostly in the uterine serous carcinomas. So very rare to see that in endometrioid or any of the other histologies. But for the uterine serous carcinoma, that's where it lies. Yep.
So getting back to immunotherapy, we talked a little bit about relative contraindications. What about people who have autoimmune complications of therapy? Of course, you have things like thyroid, which usually is pretty easy to deal with. But then other potentially much more difficult problems, colitis, pneumonitis, et cetera. What's your approach to these? And in what situation will you re-challenge like a patient who's done well but then has one of these complications?
Yes. So great points there. So I would, for those like to have a grade one or a grade two, where they may have pneumonitis or colitis, even a grade three colitis, if we can get it well controlled, those patients all go on a obviously high dose steroids and then a steroid taper typically over 4 to 6 weeks. Should definitely not be shorter than 4 weeks. And what I do, and I think most others do probably a similar thing also, is once they're off their steroids, I'm giving them 1 or 2 weeks to see what happens when they're off steroids, just to see if they're going to have rebound symptoms. Because for some of these patients, they're going to declare themselves pretty quickly that as soon as they're off steroids, it happens, the same thing happens again. And if they do okay after that 1 or 2 weeks and they had a grade one or grade two, then we'll re-challenge some of the grade threes. Kind of depends on how much of a benefit they're getting. I would consider re-challenging. There's an interesting study that we have here here also, and it uses ciltuximab, so an IL-6 inhibitor, to give in combination with immunotherapy for those patients who had an autoimmune toxicity, to see if those patients can be re-challenged again. So that study is not fully enrolled. It's not, it's been presented at some of the conferences, but well, this will be some interesting things that What can we do to overcome and more safely re-challenge those patients that had toxicity? And as I think we commonly see, it's those patients that get, oftentimes the patients who have the toxicity are also the patients that have a significant benefit from the immunotherapy. There definitely seems to be a relation between those two. So not everybody can safely go on. And I also think that not everybody necessarily has to go back on. Some patients just need one or two doses of IO when they have such a violent response and toxicity sometimes that's all they need and they continue to do well afterwards.
Yeah, it was actually the next question I was going to ask you that I just wrote down was whether you think there's a correlation of toxicity with benefit, which you just went ahead and answered anyhow. You're trying to like block part of the immune system?
IL-6. Yeah.
So is the idea that somehow you're going to block the autoimmune arm, you know, thing, mm-hmm. but not the anti-tumor thing? Wow.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's an interesting trial. And I think it's an NCI trial also. So we'll see what those outcomes are. But yeah, interesting way to overcome some of those toxicities and be able to keep people on IO for longer or re-challenge again safely.
So one final question, this really comes up so often nowadays, and we always bring it up just to see what's going on. We were talking about colorectal cancer, and there, you know, we've really seen the introduction of cell-free DNA MRD assays like Signatera there, particularly in the localized disease setting, but even metastatic disease. And of course, this is being looked at in almost every other kind of tumor you can think of. What do we know about cell-free DNA, these type of assays in gynecologic cancers, particularly endometrial?
Yeah, we're getting more and more data here. I think what we're seeing now, and I think probably the best study that we have available that looked at this and that published it also, and the data is out there, is from the DUO-E study, where they looked at those patients, whether they cleared their ctDNA and what their prognosis. For right now, I think it's a very much a prognostic marker. If you were ctDNA positive still at the end of your chemo IO, then you had higher risk of recurrence and progression versus those that were ctDNA negative. And I think at that study also we saw that sometimes there was more DNA clearance if you added a PARP inhibitor than on top of it. So that's interesting things where we are now. I think we're not quite at the point of should we treat, can we say like, oh, if you're positive, you should treat. If you're negative, we can omit treatment. But that's kind of what we're seeing, I think, in other diseases, that's going to be used as a decision maker. And hopefully we'll get a chance to get some of that information and those kind of studies out there too in endometrial cancer, and certainly would help help tailor or personalize some of the treatment duration specifically for our patients.
So I got to add one more question. As you were talking, something else popped into my head I got to ask you about, which is, I forget when, I think it was about a year ago, for the first time, you know, we've had thousands of cases presented, particularly since the pandemic with all the teleconferencing. Finally, I had a case of POLE-E, mutant endometrial cancer, who, guess what, did great on IOs, but just thought, you know, I think, you know, endometrial is the only place where I hear about POLE-E, but can you kind of like capsulize what it is and when, you know, what you do if you find a patient who's POLE-E positive?
Yeah, we don't find them very often either. I can think, count them one hand, how many POLE-E positive patients I've had. Those are those patients that are off they're the hyper-mutated patients. So when you see that NGS report that comes back and they have about every mutation you can think of, POLE-E is oftentimes one of those. But what we see with those patients is indeed they can present with that high-grade and high-grade disease, but those are actually oftentimes the ones that do better. We're starting to look at studies now, like can we safely de-escalate? The hard part is from the older studies with those POLE-E studies that the patients did so well is that they did all get either radiation or chemotherapy because they had those high-grade features. So they all were treated, and with the treatment, they did well. So the biggest question now is, did they need the treatments? And we're starting to do some de-escalation studies in the early stage. In Europe, they're a little bit farther ahead and maybe a little bit more brave than we are to do look at some observation also in the more advanced stages. But yes, so I think we're going to find out more what they need. But right now, at least for those patients that are diagnosed in, say, a stage three, those patients still are should be getting treatment until we have more of that data that we can safely omit that at this point.
Maybe those are the people who maybe do cell-free DNA on someday. I don't know. But what do you see in TMB levels in these patients?
Those are oftentimes high for those patients, yeah. But not always. It's an
Really?
interesting mix. It is an interesting mix, but most of those are going to be pretty high TMB.
This concludes our program. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. And throughout this program, the use of agents and treatments that are not approved may have been discussed. So please check out the package inserts for more. Special thanks to Dr. Backus, and thank you for tuning in. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.